From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. On today's show, a look at two new programs which hope to improve the lives of Milwaukeeans by addressing their mental health needs.
We are providing additional health-related services, primarily mental health services, for men and women who present to workforce development programming.
Later, two Milwaukee women shared their stories of how Title IX has influenced their lives in athletics.
Plus, a children's book illustrator shares his appreciation for an artist who came before him, Virginia Lee Burton, and what made her so great.
A picture book, if it has those qualities of a great book, they will have an interesting balance between the words and the picture, not only visually on the page, but the story that they're telling. They support each other, they don't repeat each other, but they tell a bigger picture together.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this year, we spoke with researchers Dimitri Topitsis and Joshua Mirsky about their work with the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being and their research on the effects of adverse childhood experiences, also known as ACEs.
These encompass a variety of things that can happen in childhood, including different forms of abuse, neglect, and household dysfunctions. Research into ACEs has found they can have a huge impact on a person's ability to succeed later in life.
Topitsis and Mirsky are both involved in new projects which seek to address ACEs as a way to improve the lives of Milwaukeeans. And to do this, they're utilizing a protocol known as TS-BERT. They sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and Dr. Topitsis starts by explaining TS-BERT and how it works.
The TS-BERT protocol, the acronym stands for Trauma Screening, Brief Intervention, and Referral to Treatment. And we developed this protocol based on the screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment protocol designed for alcohol or other drug misuse. We developed it because we thought that and were hearing from practitioners and saw in our own research that trauma exposure, including exposure to early childhood adverse experiences or adverse childhood experiences, was prominent, prevalent, and consequential in a number of different service groups, a number of different subgroups and populations that our students and that our research partners were serving. So we developed this protocol in order to screen for, talk about, and then refer for trauma-related problems.
So this is going to be implemented in your Improving Health Through Enhanced Work program, which is building on top of the state of Wisconsin's Transitional Jobs Program. Now, for people who aren't familiar with that existing program, what does that do?
So Transitional Jobs essentially offers those who are unemployed and perhaps may have been unemployed for a good period of time, chronically unemployed, for instance, offers them, adults, men and women, transitional jobs or temporary jobs that are subsidized through the state government and ultimately are meant to be temporary in nature. So they're low-paying, subsidized jobs that are temporary in nature and are meant to teach soft job skills and lead to a more permanent position. What we have found in a lot of the research for transitional jobs programs is that they have short-term positive effects on income, even on family health and well-being, but their effects tend to fade over time. In other words, permanent side of the equation is difficult to realize. The goals of attaining permanent employment and employability tend to be difficult to realize. And this is information that comes to us through systematic research. It also comes to us through sort of anecdotal evidence from staff at these various job programs who let us know that they believe in the work that they're doing, but what they find is that it's difficult for the men and women they're serving to actually attain long-term sustainable employment. The reasons tend to transcend structural problems like, for instance, jobs are hard to come by, et cetera. In fact, we have very high employment rates right now. The problem tends to be oftentimes, according to staff that we speak with, personal in nature. So individuals are facing personal problems that tend to trip them up, that tend to undermine their ability to sustain long-term employment. problems such as behavioral health issues like substance abuse, even mental health issues like depression and anxiety. And so we have data to reinforce that point, data that we've collected from 200 men in the central city of Milwaukee who are seeking job services. Josh Mirsky, David Pate, and I collected these data, analyzed the information, and found that, in fact, mental health-related issues, behavioral health-related issues tend to undermine men's ability. We sampled only men, undermine men's ability to sustain long-term employment. It also turned out that, according to our data, exposure to childhood trauma also tended to be a part of this story, tended to contribute to later problems like substance abuse or mental health issues, which then in turn tend to undermine long-term employability, which is why, in part, we developed the trauma screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment protocol and are now implementing it within a workforce development context.
Is there a reason you only sampled men?
The reason being at the time is because our research partners were primarily only serving men in the context in which we were partnering with them.
So you just mentioned improving health through enhanced work, which is the new program that's going to be implemented. And it's kind of an experiment, really. You're experimenting with the new program. What is that going to look like?
So essentially what we're doing is we are providing additional health-related services, primarily mental health services, for men and women who present to workforce development programming. And we're trying to enhance their experience of these programs, these workforce development programs, by introducing these health-related services. And the way in which we introduce these health-related services is through this trauma screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment protocol. So we have, we screen for exposure to trauma. We screen for experience of trauma symptoms. And then we have a conversation, a motivationally informed conversation. It's informed by motivational interviewing principles. And we essentially query patients about their coping mechanisms. How do they cope with, in other words, their experience of stress and trauma? And if they, in fact, would like to talk to someone, a counselor, a mental health practitioner, to increase or enhance their coping skills, but also perhaps even talk about their exposure, their experience of trauma and stress. And what we find is most people, according to the research that we've done previous to this project, most people actually appreciate this conversation, are happy to talk about these really significant issues if they are approached in a respectful way. And then most people will even accept a referral to mental health services or counseling services in order to, as I just mentioned, strengthen their coping skills and, in fact, talk about these somewhat overwhelming experiences that tend to linger in their memory systems.
So part of what you're doing with the Improving Health Through Enhanced Work program is incentivizing accessing mental health care, or healthcare more generally. How do you incentivize something like that?
We're really trying to facilitate access to mental health care, not necessarily to incentivize it. Facilitate by virtue of having an informed, a rich, and client-centered conversation about the effects of trauma, the lingering effects of traumatic stress, and ways in which one can cope with traumatic stress that are helpful, healthy, self-promotive, et cetera. And by virtue of having a motivationally informed or motivational interview-based conversation about these issues, we try to enhance one's motivation to seek services rather than incentivize from the outside. And we try to create intrinsic motivation as opposed to extrinsic motivation for seeking services and for addressing these issues. Because as I mentioned previously, these are the types of lingering problems that can undermine one's functionality, can impair one's functionality, and undermine one's ability to sustain employment, aside from just enjoy one's life and create sort of craft an enjoyable, satisfying lifestyle for oneself. So the word, rather than I would say incentivize, is to motivate, to help cultivate intrinsic motivation to address these problems in a systematic and potent way.
So kind of moving aside from this specific program, you also have a new project, the Trauma and Recovery Project. which is really putting a laser focus on the needs of people in Milwaukee and Racine counties. I guess to start here, what are the current barriers to accessing this kind of trauma-focused care?
It's an excellent question, Joy. And the barriers are multiple. And the barriers exist both at a systemic level as well as at an individual and family level. So at a systemic level, our work often focuses on children and families who enter into the child welfare system. And there are barriers at a policy level, at a funding level, in terms of what federal child welfare funding will pay for. So much of the funding for child welfare comes through the Social Security Act. Much of that is through Title IV-E of the Social Security Act. And those funds typically go toward paying for things like out-of-home care placement, making sure kids who are removed from the home have a safe and stable placement. It will pay for training of staff and things of that nature. What the funds do not pay for is direct service. So most dollars that flow from the federal government to states and localities for these children and families do not pay for the kinds of rich therapeutic services that Dimitri was talking about with the T-ESPRT model or with the types of services that we're going to be promoting through the Trauma and Recovery Project.
So how does the Trauma and Recovery Project really address those barriers?
It's a great question. Currently, the state has developed an existing project that they call the Wisconsin Trauma Project. And we're very thankful for all the investments that they've made. And the state has really made great strides. They deserve a great deal of credit for the work that they've done in expanding access to evidence-based trauma-focused treatments like trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, like child-parent psychotherapy. And with this project also, we'll be expanding access to parent-child interaction therapy. So what this project will do that is a bit different is that, first of all, it will have a laser focus on Milwaukee and Racine counties. And we all know the significant challenges that our community faces. So we're excited to expand the number of clinicians or practitioners that deliver these kinds of evidence-based services in our community. But this project goes beyond that as well. Some of the barriers to service don't just stem from a lack of clinicians who deliver these kinds of really rich services. There are also barriers to actually getting these children and families into care. So we're going to be focused, for example, on developing more standardized, structured, and routine ways of screening and assessing children and making sure that those children, when they enter into the child welfare system, that they're not only screened and assessed appropriately, but then they're referred to these treatment providers who deliver these evidence-based services. And in turn, hopefully we can help to then move the needle in terms of promoting their health and well-being.
One of the things that you've continued to say, evidence-based treatments, when I was reading through the materials that you sent me, that really stuck out to me, the idea that we need to train more clinicians in evidence-based practices, because to me that says there are a lot of clinicians currently working without evidence-based treatments or not using evidence-based. Is that accurate? Is that true?
Yes and no, right? So there's different forms of evidence, right? And Dimitri, in fact, invoked sort of empirical evidence, which researchers tend to focus on based on certain standards of science, right? And the gold standard being randomized controlled trials. And the kinds of therapeutic approaches that I was talking about, like trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy or parent-child interaction therapy, are evidence-based in the way that scientists consider them. They've been tested through rigorous trials. But you also have to honor anecdotal evidence, practitioners, clinical evidence, wisdom of serving children and families time after time again. And that evidence is valuable as well. So do I think that there are many practitioners who operate without that level of evidence? Of course not. They have their own practice wisdom. Are there practitioners that are not implementing necessarily the kinds of models and interventions that have been demonstrated through science to be efficacious? Yeah, that certainly is an issue in the field. And we certainly want to promote best practices and promote interventions that we know that work. If you have a choice between implementing one intervention that you think might work versus an intervention that has been demonstrated to work through science, I think there's good reason to choose the latter.
What are the next steps for both of these programs? What comes next?
So for the Trauma and Recovery Project, we're really in the early stages, and it's an exciting partnership. Dimitri and I are very excited about our partnership with Children's Hospital around this work. And at our Institute for Child and Family Wellbeing, we're essentially using this project to help to deepen our commitment to being sort of an incubator of innovative, promising, and evidence-based practices. And so this SAMHSA grant that we received with the Department of Children and Families and the State Department Office of Children's Mental Health is going to allow us to establish ourselves as sort of what we're terming a center of excellence, and what SAMHSA terms a center of excellence. So the next steps for us are to work with the Department of Children and Families at the state and the Office of Children's Mental Health to develop at their level a system of care to support the implementation and sustainability of these kinds of evidence-based trauma-focused practices. And then at a local level here at the Institute, we'll be actually implementing these services at Children's Hospital, both in Racine and in Milwaukee. And again, we're going to be delivering three different models that can be provided to children of essentially of all ages. The models we selected were designed because they serve children of different age ranges and who present with different sort of symptom profiles. And so we're going to be able to increase access to children of all ages who enter into the child welfare system or who are at risk of being placed in out-of-home care.
For the Improving Health Through Enhanced Work Project, we're still in the first year of project funding. We're currently engaged sort of in ramp-up efforts, implementation ramp-up efforts. So in concert with the Public Policy Institute over at Community Advocates, namely Connor Williams and Julie Kirksick, what we've been doing is we've been identifying our community partners, our workforce development programs, and we're delighted to be working with at least four right now, including ProTrade, Employ Milwaukee, Center for Self-Sufficiency, and Milwaukee Jobs Work. And we're very excited to be working with these programs because they are, in individualized ways, implementing the T-ESPRT protocol with our guidance and support in order to create a more holistic workforce development service menu for their service recipients. We're really quite excited about that. Along with the implementation efforts, now we are also going to start collecting data in order first to develop a clear profile of who are the men and women that they're serving, and then secondly, to assess whether or not the services that they're providing are actually improving work and health-related outcomes.
Well, I look forward to seeing more of your work, and thank you both so much for coming in and speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Dimitri Topitsis and Dr. Joshua Mirsky are both associate professors at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. They're also the co-founders of the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being, and they spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
Two Milwaukee women reflect on how Title IX affected their lives in sports when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this month, we spoke with a former commissioner of the WNBA, the Women's National Basketball Association, who will speak at an event this week in Milwaukee on the legacy of Title IX, 45 years after the landmark legislation was enacted.
Title IX has had a significant impact on millions of people in the academic setting, especially in the world of athletics, where women and girls now have many more opportunities than they had half a century ago.
Joining us in the studio are two Milwaukee women whose experience in sports was shaped by Title IX. Nikki Barnes played volleyball for 4 years at the Division I level at Marquette, starting in 2013. Brunell Hooker has been in basketball for 4 decades, most recently as the owner and president of the semi-pro Milwaukee Aces. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it.
There are a lot of people talking about this anniversary of Title IX this year, and Title IX touches a lot of things, but both of you have been involved in women's sports over the years. Can you talk about your understanding maybe of how Title IX has shaped the athletes and the work in sports that you've done?
I would say my biggest thing I'm taking away from Title IX is the work it's done to get me the opportunities I've been afforded. being able to play volleyball on equal opportunity teams all growing up and see my sisters who are younger than me going through the same thing, and then having no trouble going through the recruiting process and coming to Marquette to play and having an awesome experience there just goes to show all the legwork that's been put in. By no means is Title IX run its course. The problems are not solved, but I think just the great experience I've had my whole life with sports speaks volumes to the work it's done, and my biggest understanding of it is just look how far we've come, but let's keep going.
When you were like a high school athlete or playing at Marquette, did you really even know about the history either of Title IX or the fact that it wasn't always this way for women and girls?
I think starting in high school and beyond, I had an understanding that there was such a thing as Title IX, but my understanding of really all the work it is currently doing and has been doing was little to none. I don't think I ever thought too much about the struggles that women before me have had, even like my mom's age growing up and younger even. I definitely did not have as much of an appreciation for their struggles as I should have, but just having such the easy and great experience I did, I was very appreciative of that all along, but it definitely speaks for all the work Title IX's been doing.
Brinell Hooker, I don't know that this is telling tales out of school. You might be a couple years older than Nikki Barnes. Can you share, first of all, your Title IX experience, and secondly, the same kind of question, you know, the understanding of what came before and what's here now?
Thank you, Mitch, and I'm proud to say I'm 57. So I was at the age when Title IX first started. So I've seen a lot of the changes for me growing up. But what I've noticed much of is how the sport changed, the competition changed, those opportunities to be able to have the gym more. So those type of things Nikki may not have seen because at her age, it's granted to you now. But back then, it was a fight to get into a gym, to equal opportunities for women in sports. So that's the big difference I see, the opportunities of women and girls participating in sports. Yeah, there's struggles, but I honor Nikki for her truthfulness because you think about it, her day and age is a given. Sports is a given. And back in my day, we didn't take it for granted. And we knew the struggles, and we had to fight through things. But just to see it grow, and seeing the accomplishments of these young women nowadays is just awesome to see.
You are in charge of a basketball team today, but I gather that must mean you had playing days in the past, right?
I had playing days in the past, yes. In fact, my first opportunity to play in a team was in high school. Like I said, Title IX just really got started. So I fouled out my first game in 2 minutes. I learned my lesson. But after those couple of years in high school, I ended up getting a scholarship. I'm playing basketball. After that, I ended up having a coaching position for at MSOE for my first coaching job. So I coached collegiately for 25 years in various colleges here in the area. A nonprofit, Images of Us Sports, we also talk about Title IX because these young ladies need to understand how sports began and how young it is. Even the championship games are young. Title IX, 45 years old. I'm older than Title IX. Come on. So it's the opportunities to see these advancements, giving these girls that opportunity to also understand what Title IX means and what it means for the future.
Over the 25 years you coached in college, did you see things? I mean, I would imagine that there was a growing period for what Title IX was able to accomplish. Mm-hmm. Were there days when you were still fighting for time in the gym and, you know, opportunities that had always existed for the men's athletes?
Oh, yeah. When it comes to practice times, we're in the practice later. The guys are huddling around the gym waiting for us to get off the floor. So, there's an urgency when it came to practicing. Scheduling the game was not an issue. I had to give it to the colleges and university I worked at. It flowed. But you can see the difference from the men's and the women. And that's what you had to talk to your players about, those differences and how we have to overcome them and even fight for it.
What was the attitude towards women's sports at Marquette in the 4 years you were there? Did it ever feel like you were second fiddle to men's sports?
I can honestly say I never felt like that. I can't speak for all my teammates, but I would say the general feeling overall was that if you are at Marquette playing a sport, you're there for a reason and you're appreciated and well taken care of. I think a lot of it has to do with how far Marquette's come. They have the respect and the funding to be able to take care of all their student athletes equally and all very well. We were afforded the same benefits as the men's basketball team, who I'm sure is much more popular from bystanders.
It might bring in a little more money than the
right.
women's volleyball team.
Exactly. But we were afforded the same tutors, the same advisors, the same chefs, the same locker room privileges. So definitely there was not any discrepancies that I could see.
Would the Burnell of 30 or 40 years ago have believed it if she had heard that there would be a time when women's athletes would have chefs and tutors and
oh my
all
gosh.
The same kinds of opportunities?
No. Never thought of that. And those years going through the ranks, and you sit and you watch the men's games, and it really was not a big of a difference. But Title IX is beyond sports as well. I think one of the biggest issues when it came to Title IX was the campus harassments, those type of things. But when it came to sports, they did try to put that equal piece in there for both men and women's team. But Title IX is bigger than sports.
It's bigger than just men and women,
it's
right?
It's bigger than men and women as well. It's just a piece of it. But that little piece really helped the growth of women's sports.
Let me ask you a little bit about your lives today. You graduated after playing 4 years of volleyball. Are you still out there as an athlete today?
I am. Definitely a much less competitive level. I played in a beach league over the summer, and I'm currently playing in just a once-a-week league, still on Marquette's campus, actually, with a couple of other old players. So I'm trying to keep it in my life, and I have six younger siblings, five of which play volleyball, so I try to get home on the weekends and see their games. My sister is currently in her freshman season at the University of Minnesota, so I'm following her. It's definitely still very much a part of my life.
Well, and I imagine you were able to share your collegiate experiences to mm-hmm. sort of help prepare her for hers.
Absolutely. She got to come up and see quite a few of my games, and as soon as we knew where she was going and that she was going to be playing at such a high level, she had a million questions for me, and I was kind of trying to mentor her about the best way to take it all in, and because it is a lot to handle, especially as a freshman, balancing a travel schedule with a full class schedule and just kind of being used to being away from home. So just kind of helping her get used to her surroundings.
So I did this interview a little while ago with a former president of the WNBA and asked somewhat kiddingly, why there's not a WNBA team in Milwaukee. And I was informed that while there is not a WNBA team here, there is a semi-pro team. And I'm ashamed to say I did not know about the Milwaukee Aces. Give us a thumbnail sketch of who you are and you know, who plays for you.
Well, Milwaukee Aces, we're going on to our fourth season. It derived from an organization, Images of Us Sports, or IOU Sports. We teach girls the business of sports. And as you know, there aren't any professional sports teams, women's sports teams here in Wisconsin. So an opportunity came presented to me to obtain a team, and I'm named it after my parents, AC and Edna Hooker, so it's the Milwaukee Aces. And we have players from they came from Wisconsin, went to school elsewhere, college that is, and they're back home and they want to still play. And those are the players we seek for. Terry Stamps from Milwaukee Vincent, Shalane Landry from Vincent. Wow, I have Alyssa Cola from Mequinica. So we have these women that's from Wisconsin, play Division I basketball, some Division II and III, but they're here in Wisconsin wanting to play in front of their family and friends again. And we give them an opportunity. But there are some who want to play overseas. So we help them with that process of playing overseas. And Milwaukee Aces is strong. You see more of us. Some of the struggles is the sponsorships, but we're going to work with that. We're working with that. Like 4 years, we'll be together for 4 years. So if we've been here this long, obviously we're doing something right. We have a great fan base that's growing. We want Wisconsin to know they do have a team, and it's the Milwaukee Aces.
And the third season was over not too long ago, right?
It was over August. We were lost the championship game, but you know what? We'll be back strong. Our fourth year to take the trophy back here to Wisconsin.
And the season begins when?
Our season starts May and ends in August. So we play during the WNBA. Our ultimate goal through the Global Women's Basketball Association is to become a D-League. We're trying to convince the WNBA this should be a D-League for these women who are not making it to the WNBA, and they want somewhere to play. So we want to be a viable source for these women who are looking for a place to play, and we're here.
Well, Brunell Hooker, Nikki Barnes, good luck to both of you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Brunell Hooker is owner and president of the Milwaukee Aces basketball team and also founder and CEO of the nonprofit Images of Us Sports. Nikki Barnes was a four-year member of the Marquette University's women's volleyball team. Today, she's a business analyst at Baird.
Both will be among the athletes honored on Wednesday at a Women's Fund of Greater Milwaukee event marking the 45th anniversary of Title IX. You'll find a link to more information at WUWN.
We'll take another break now, and then we'll learn about the life of another groundbreaking woman, the iconic children's book author and illustrator Virginia Lee Burton. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Even if you don't have children, or it's been a long time since you were a child, or both, you'd probably recognize the artwork of Virginia Lee Burton. Burton wrote and illustrated picture books in the first half of the 20th century, books that are still staples of classroom and home libraries around the world.
Burton's titles included Mike Mulligan and His Steam Shovel, The Little House, Katie and the Big Snow, and more. But it is Burton herself who is at the center of a new picture book by contemporary writer Sherry Rinker and illustrator John Rocco. They joined us in the studio recently to share their work. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Mitch. Thanks.
Can you both talk about what Virginia Lee Burton, Ginny, meant to each of you as you were perhaps children reading books and today in your professional careers?
Sure. I grew up with The Little House. That was the singular book that I most remember from my childhood. And I knew The Little House and I knew Mike Mulligan and His Steam Shovel, loved them both. And as a parent, a few years later, I met also Katie, the snowplow, and Mabel, the cable car, and Choo Choo, and really got to experience those books through my kids, which was a rather lovely way to read them and see them, and the books that I was familiar with before, see them in a new light.
Right. There's something to be said for a book that had a series of books that is timeless enough for you to have read as a child to then read to your own children.
Absolutely. How amazing is that? And, you know, I had the good fortune of presenting at a library not so long ago, and I had read my own books. And during question and answer, one of the kids said, "What was your favorite book growing up?" And I'd said, "Oh, I loved a book by Virginia Lee Burton called The Little House." And the librarian was just Johnny on the spot, handed me the book. I read the book to this group of, I don't know, 20, 25 first and second graders mostly. And when I finished the book, they applauded. And this is a book that was written 75 years ago. So, you know, what more can you say about the quality of her storytelling?
John Rocco, did Virginia Lee Burton hold any particular significance to you?
You know, I had a couple of her books as a kid smattered amongst the Dr. Seuss library canon. And I remember them more now after having researched her work and studying her work, which we had an amazing opportunity to do. We went to visit with her son, and he pulled down all of these boxes of her sketchbooks and her drawings and her linoleum plates, and we were able to go through all of it, and it really opened my eyes to what an amazing designer she was of books. And as someone who's been making books for the last 10 years, I have a whole new appreciation for the thought process behind laying out text and image
Right, talk about the distinction between illustrating and designing, because I think that's something that people probably don't appreciate.
Well, illustrating basically represents the drawing the pictures, and designing the book is kind of the integration of the pictures and the words. A picture book, if it has those qualities of a great book, they will have an interesting balance between the words and the picture, not only visually on the page, but the story that they're telling. They support each other. They don't repeat each other, but they tell a bigger picture together.
Sure. You talked about this sort of seminal moment when you got to read The Little House to these young children. Mm-hmm. When did the light bulb go off that Virginia Lee Burton as a subject was ideal for a children's book?
You know, I actually had the idea almost from the time I first became a children's book author. I really wanted to pay tribute and homage in some way to this woman that I really felt had been just so ahead of her time, was so amazing. And I remember even in the, you know, right after my first book, which was Goodnight, Goodnight Construction Site, after that came out in 2011, I had talked to people that I would be visiting with at a conference or whatever. And I would keep getting the same answer. Wow, that would be tough. You know, it'd be tough to, you know, do a book about somebody who does books. But I really had been toying with the idea for a long time, and one day just, you know, really started to take a stab in it. There were some things that I knew I wanted to say. I wanted her to be very much in the present tense because her stories are very much alive. And it was also important to me that the sort of the cadence of the story was appealing to my age group of children and which was also her age group of children. So I didn't want something very academic. I wanted a story that sort of captured the essence of her magic and her ability to tell stories, and stories that were very much inspired by her children.
John, Sherry was talking about the challenge of doing this, and you were sort of wholeheartedly nodding over at your microphone. What made this especially challenging as an illustrator?
I have to say, you know, when I got the manuscript, what I loved about it was that it chose to focus on this one aspect of her life, but it included details about the rest of her incredibly, like, packed life.
She's really a Renaissance woman.
She did everything, you know, and she danced, and she made fabrics, and she cooked, she threw parties, you know, all of this stuff. And these are things that I learned much later than the manuscript was written, but it made it refreshing. And this is my first sort of entree into nonfiction as an illustrator. And to answer your question more specifically, yes, illustrating a book about a children's book illustrator and a children's book illustrator as amazing as Virginia Lee Burton was, those were big shoes to fill. So there was a lot of thought put into how I was going to portray her creating her work on the page.
I imagine there is a fine line between paying tribute and imitating.
Absolutely. And in a sense, you know, I wanted to capture each one of these. She goes through in the story, she's inventing the characters for her most famous books. And her approach to all of those books was a little bit different. And so I wanted to make sure I showed that. And so I sort of created one style for the part of this play, if you will, that I was creating. And then show her creating her own work.
How important was the buy-in from Virginia Lee Burton's descendants to be able to actually do this book this way?
Well, fortunately,
it was imperative.
Yeah. I don't think we could have done
the
it without
unauthorized biography.
Yeah, I don't think it would have worked. I mean, there would have been possibly copyright issues. So when I had written the manuscript, I asked my agent to submit it exclusively to HMH, which is her house. It's the house that still publishes her work. And it took a little while to
HMH, for people who don't know,
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Mm-hmm. And it took a little while for them to get back to me because they sent the manuscript to her family. And to hear that not only were they on board, they were delighted, they were honored, excited, and really have brought us into their family. I mean, you know, John was getting correspondence from Eris's wife just a day or two ago, and Mike, for whom Mike Mulligan was named, we lost him unfortunately last fall, but his wife has been just lovely to us. And both of them, both Eris and Eileen and Eleanor, Eris and Eileen in California and Eleanor in Florida, have had us into their homes to look through archives and personal effects and photographs and sketchbooks, and they've been really quite lovely.
During the process, I brought artwork up to Eris's house. And Eris, her son, is also an artist, an amazing sculptor with sculptures all over the country. And he really gave me the thumbs up as I was sort of midway through the production of the art, which was great. And he also pointed out places where I needed to, you know, like she always wore a wedding ring, so you have to put that on there. And I always had a cowlick, he said, so... Those were details that you couldn't get if you, you know, were just going off of what you read about someone.
And, you know, I've talked to a number of author-illustrator pairs over the years, and I would say the vast majority had almost no, if any, contact before the book was a finished product. And clearly you had the manuscript already, but at that point, how closely did the two of you work together?
Well, I think that we worked together on the aspects of research because we were invited into their homes and into their lives. So none of that would have happened without Sherry just kind of taking the wheel and saying, all right, we're going to Eris's house on this day and you need to be there because this is going to be amazing. And so I, you know, jumped in my car and drove up to Santa Barbara.
It
and
makes me sound so pushy.
You?
No. Not I.
And at first I was kind of on the fence, like, really? We need to do this? And I'm converted to doing that kind of research, and it was amazing. It was just the greatest day. Because when you're holding the sketchbooks in your hand and you're looking through someone's work, you get an insight into how they think and how they think about creating books and why they do certain things. And you can see that in their thought process.
Is it at all weird? I mean, you know, you're both creative people, and I imagine you have sketchbooks and you have drafts and notebooks with bits and pieces. And these aren't necessarily things that you do expecting anybody else to see. Is there, you know, ever a feeling of like you're kind of eavesdropping or seeing a part of the creative process that was never meant to be seen?
I never had that sense. It just felt like such an honor to be. And she did save everything. And her children have saved everything. I just felt like it was just an amazing opportunity to get a glimpse into how she thought. And while, you know, the manuscript had been written at that point, I think it's been tremendously helpful, not to put words in your mouth, but for both of us in presenting and going around the country talking to people about her, to have even a better insight into, you know, what she did and the depth of her work and the amazing array of styles she was capable of doing. And even as we were going through sketchbooks, we could see her love of her children. You couldn't go very far without seeing sketches of her children sleeping or of the boys playing outside. So that, you know, she was constantly inspired by everything. But as a mother myself, my heart is just swells thinking about the tremendous love that she had for these boys, because, you know, I have two boys myself.
How old
are your
kids?
I created my books for them. When I wrote my first book, they were 2 and 6. Now they are 12 and 16. So as you know, it flies, time flies. But but I relate to her as a mother and a creative person.
With regards to your question, as an illustrator myself, I know that a lot of my sketches are complete garbage and should be in the garbage. But her marks on paper were so confident and so beautiful that I imagine that she's probably very happy that people are actually looking at them. So, you know, I couldn't find a bad drawing in any of
well,
those.
And yeah. Your point that she saved all these things is a good one, and your point that you know, some of what you do is garbage is a good one, because maybe maybe some of what she did was garbage too, and that she just didn't
maybe
save
she
that stuff.
That, yeah,
that's true.
That's fair. I think, you know, with regard to your question, so once John started to sketch, I was so fortunate that my editor included me and gave opportunities for feedback from the very earliest stages that she saw. And I tend to be quite critical, but I thought John really hit it out of the park. I couldn't have been more pleased with what I saw from the very earliest stages of the game. It just has really come together even more lovely than I imagined.
And I didn't even know you'd seen them.
Well, and it's interesting because you were in the odd position of, you know, sort of having to live up to Virginia Lee Burton and to Sherry at the same time.
Yes. And the editor and the sales and marketing. And
not that there was
else.
Any pressure at all.
Yeah,
well, and this house that held her whole legacy was all evaluating this with such scrutiny, which yeah. I think... So good job, John.
Well, and that's something. I mean, obviously the HRH people are not in here, but they did have a big stake, maybe even more so than usual, because not only are they putting out your book, but right, they are maintaining the legacy of this beloved author illustrator.
Absolutely.
Yeah, part of the magic of what this does, as children today read this book, it turns them on to all of her other books, which is a great thing. Whenever you have a book that can turn kids on to other books, especially ones that are so amazing as Virginia Lee Burton's, I think you've got a great thing, you know.
It's a literary gateway drug.
Exactly. I'll be back for more.
Have you thought of becoming a Virginia Lee Burton impersonator?
Yes, I have. Thank you for asking, Mitch.
Well, it is terrific stuff. And and really, you know, I think speaking as a parent who, of course, has read, you know, any number of these books to his own children some years ago and remembers in particular Mike Mulligan from my own childhood, it really is something to know something about the person who wrote and drew them as well.
Thank you.
So thanks to both of you for spending some time with us.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
And hope we'll see you again.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Mike Mulligan had a steam shovel. Marianne was her name. The two of them were the best darn pair. At least that was the claim.
Sherry Rinker is the author and John Rocco the illustrator of Big Machines, the story of Virginia Lee Burton. They joined us in the studio on a recent trip to Milwaukee.
One last break, and then we'll listen to a Lake Effect studio session with Welsh musician Martin Joseph. We'll be back in a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Mike Mulligan and Marianne, they dug the highway straight. Airport runways, landing fields, you never had to wait. When Mike and Marianne would dig, this they liked the best. How crowds of people standing round always were impressed. 'Cause Marianne the steam shovel, Mike Mulligan would say, what 100 men could dig in a week, she could dig in a day.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We have a few minutes to close today's show to hear a recent recording from the Lake Effect Performance Studio.
Welsh singer-songwriter Martin Joseph played in Cedarburg a couple of weeks ago. He was opening for Milwaukee's Willie Porter. Before the show, he stopped by the Lake Effect Studio and played us a few songs, including this one, which was inspired by his first visit to the United States many years ago.
California's highway kingdom burns brown in the evening air. The cars go cruising for Nirvana from Newport Beach up to Big Sur. And the lovers flirt with the passing magic amongst the surfboard tunes as I recall a former age of Dick Van Dyke and all those Beach Boy tunes. Need something to believe in. It's such a long, long time till dawn. I'm gonna drive down to the desert, to the place where souls are born. And there I'll hear the mountains sing out, where the earth holds peace it seems. I want to wish you better days as Arizona dreams, as Arizona dreams, the wonder of that name. Those Arizona dreams will help me breathe again. America, you've seen some changes, though you've been there all my years. As a child you so loved Lucy, and as a man you drank in cheers. But now you cry on Oprah Winfrey, alternative line. Now you fight on Jerry Springer. You wring your hands at the downtown riots. You worry that you've lost your great beauty, so you switch to low-carb diets. Those Arizona dreams, it's the wonder of that name. Those Arizona dreams help me breathe again, breathe again, yeah, yeah. Full of former heroes, all those gentlemen that wrote you hymns of praise. Talking Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Paul Robeson, that spirit lingers. So turn up Springsteen and glory days. This is your land, hear your soul, speak in your mountains and your streams, cause there can be, there will be grace again. As Arizona dreams. Arizona dreams, it's the wonder of that name. Those Arizona dreams to help you breathe again. Those Arizona dreams, it's the wonder of that name. Those Arizona dreams, no sunset is the same.
Martin Joseph playing his song Arizona Dreams in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Joseph opened for Milwaukee's Willie Porter at the Cedarburg Cultural Center earlier this month. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Don't forget to join us in Oak Creek tomorrow evening as we record our first Lake Effect on site. We will be at Three Cellars at South 27th, which is just south of Rawson. The doors open at 6:30 and the recording starts at 7. You can find lots more information at WUWM.com, and we hope to see you there.
And we thank you so much for tuning in today and hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.